That's really low snow to go ahead and go over that type of terrain.
Moved again. The Iditarod restart will be in Fairbanks this year because of snow problems in the Dalzell Gorge. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, February 10th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, legislation that would bring back a state income tax.
This plan balances those two aspects so that all families across Alaska are participants and have skin in the game.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Artists, show us how you inspire Alaska. Apply now for an individual artist award. Deadline is March 1st. Learn more at rasmussen.org/IAA. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
Once again, the Iditarod is moving to Fairbanks. The race's board of directors met today in Anchorage and voted unanimously to change the starting point from Willow to Fairbanks. Almost immediately after the decision was made behind closed doors, race director Mark Nordman held a press conference that local TV station KTVA broadcast live on Facebook.
Everybody was really somber. We went through communities and effects with of course, thinking of the dogs first and the mushers and communities and the cultural aspects and the economics, and everybody knows what a big decision this was to make and how it does affect so many. These are very good friends of Iditarod's out there, and, it's tough for all of us.
This is the third time the restart has moved to Fairbanks in the race's 45-year history, and it's the second time in a row the event will not take the southern route, skipping communities like Anvik, Shagaluk, and Grayling. The Fairbanks Trail heads west toward Galena before veering north to Hooslea, then back down to the Yukon. The general routing is similar to the original 1925 trail used during Nome's diphtheria outbreak. Nordman says in spite of good winter conditions across the vast majority of the traditional route, snow is unacceptably low in one critical section of the trail in the Alaska Range around Rainy Pass and into the Dalzell Gorge.
Fairbanks has good snow, even the coast has good snow, McGrath has good snow, but nobody was thinking snow. When you start seeing 12, 14 inches up in the mountains, that's really low snow to go ahead and go over that type of terrain, so we're used to feet.
Organizers were heavily criticized in 2014 when they decided to allow mushers to race through that same section of the trail. Ice and abysmal snow conditions led to injuries and equipment damage. The Iditarod ceremonial start will still take place in Anchorage on the first Saturday in March. After that, teams will head to Fairbanks, where the restart will take off on Monday the 6th. Alaskans would pay a tax on income for the first time since 1980 under a bill introduced in the legislature today. The bill also would draw money from the permanent fund to pay for the state government's budget, and it would set a new formula for permanent fund dividends. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports.
The new bill is the biggest visible sign yet of the shift in the majority of the state House of Representatives. Income tax proposals went no further than committee hearings under the previous Republican-led House majority, but the new, mostly Democratic majority may advance the bill quickly. Homer Representative Paul Seaton is one of three Republicans who switched caucuses. He also helped write the new legislation, House Bill 115.
The basic question is, what kind of Alaska do you want to live in? And our constituents have told us that they want to see an Alaska that has a thriving economy, that has good schools, that has troopers in the court system running well. And without some kind of a deficit reduction, broad-based, comprehensive plan, we don't get that.
The bill would set the income tax at 15% of federal liability. For example, a couple with taxable income of $75,000 would pay about $10,000 in federal taxes and $1,500 in state taxes. The bill would give Alaskans the option of using some or all of their permanent fund dividends to pay the tax. The bill would draw a little under 5% annually from the permanent fund, from the fund's earnings account. That's a little less than Governor Bill Walker has proposed. one-third of that money would go to PFDs. That would allow dividends to be $1,100 this year, more than the roughly $1,000 Walker proposed.
The majority caucus in the House formed around the principle of passing a comprehensive, sustainable fiscal plan. And so that's what we have.
Seaton says the bill includes three of the pillars of the new House majority, including new revenue, a draw on the permanent fund, and changing permanent fund dividends. The fourth element is budget cuts and changes to the oil and gas tax system. He says the income tax provides balance by requiring higher income residents to contribute, while the PFD cut affects lower income residents more.
This plan balances those two aspects so that all families across Alaska are participants and have skin in the game.
The bill would also tax capital gains at 10%. Seaton says his goal was to tax the sale of stocks and bonds at a similar rate as income. The bill drew swift opposition from minority caucus Republicans. Anchorage Representative Lance Pruitt objected to the bill being sponsored by the House Finance Committee. He says it would be wrong to add an income tax during a recession.
Now you understand why I don't want my name associated with this. Now you understand why I don't want to have anything to do with a bill that's going to look in a time when people are struggling to say, we need more money from you.
Wasilla Republican Representative Kathy Tilton says House Finance Committee co-chairman Seaton and Nome Democrat Neil Foster shouldn't have used their authority to introduce the bill as committee-sponsored legislation.
Just because you can doesn't mean you should. Regardless of what's been done in the past does not preclude a new standard of decorum.
Senate leaders, including Fairbanks Republican Senate President Pete Kelly, have also said they're opposed to an income tax. The Senate majority supports $750 million in cuts over 3 years and a constitutional limit on spending. But Seaton says the public is willing to pay a tax to avoid deep cuts to government that he says would harm the economy. He noted that Alaskans paid 16% of federal liability before the income tax was abolished. And he pointed to a Senate majority poll that found support for a broad-based tax. The bill is scheduled for hearings on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, and for public testimony next Friday. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
A local environmental group is calling on regulators to shut down a leaking gas line in Cook Inlet until it is repaired. The leak, first reported by the Alaska Dispatch News, is coming from an 8-inch gas pipeline owned by Hillcorp. In the news report, Hillcorp characterized the leak as low risk and said the appropriate response agencies were notified. But in a letter sent today to regulators, Cook Inlet Keeper accused both Hillcorp and Cook Inlet Spill Prevention and Response of downplaying the incident. Cook Inlet Keeper's Bob Shavelson says the leak is a serious environmental threat.
Dealing with the oil and gas industry in Cook Inlet, whenever there's a leak, it's always minimized at first. And so that's what I believe we saw here. And I think the reality is that you've got a sizable risk and it needs to be addressed.
Todd Paxson, general manager of Cook Inlet Spill Prevention and Response, maintains the leak is low risk and says Hillcorp is aggressively seeking a solution to the issue. Hillcorp did not return a request for comment in time for broadcast. The Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation said it could not provide an estimate for the size of the leak at this time. According to DEC, the leaking pipeline runs from Nikiski to an offshore platform that was built in 1964. Hillcorp first reported the leak to DEC on Tuesday afternoon. Based in Texas, Hillcorp is relatively new to Alaska. Over the last 5 years, it has become the largest natural gas producer in Cook Inlet. State regulators recently hit Hillcorp with a series of fines for safety and environmental violations. Alaska marijuana regulators raided several retail pot shops that appeared to be selling oil made from marijuana plants in violation of state law. The Alaska Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office, in a Thursday release, said enforcement officers seized items from several stores in the state that contained cannabinol oil or CBD oil and appeared to be offered for sale. CBD is non-psychoactive, but the office says such oils fall outside the scope of current state law. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, finding happiness in HUNA. A unique program helps students improve their outlook on life.
I can see that a lot more people are upbeat than normal, and if it stays, it stays.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
As it turns out, you don't need to wear a cape to save the community or a giant S on your chest to stand up for what's right. That's because the University of Alaska is working to build a better future for our state. Through education, the university is developing a skilled workforce with more teachers, engineers, and nurses to move Alaska forward. Join the university in leading the change Alaska needs. Visit drivechangeak.org to learn more. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
An ordinance to ban the homeless from camping in Juneau's downtown core continues to generate controversy. Now there's questions over whether a ban could affect Juneau's access to federal housing dollars. KTOO's Jacob Resnick reports.
There's been a lot of outcry over a proposed ordinance that would ban homeless people from camping in the capital city's historic downtown. Proponents say it's a public safety issue. Opponents say a camping ban would just move the problem around. The membership of Juneau's Downtown Business Association is itself divided, but a majority of its board members voted to support the initiative. That's because many merchants and their employees report feeling increasingly unsafe by people who loiter and sleep in alcoves in the commercial center. Eric Forrest owns the Red Dog Saloon. He's operated downtown businesses for about 20 years. He says there have always been homeless people around, but that in the last 18 months or so, there's been
younger, meaner, more aggressive element that does not want to be helped. And that's what this is targeted at.
Homeless residents have also weighed in. People like Mary Bailey. She's 46 years old and stays at the Glory Hole shelter. But at times, she's bedded down in a downtown business's alcove to stay warm.
I mean, that's the only place that could, like, protect us from the weather. So, I mean, what's going to happen? I mean, we need something. What about a tent city? And if that law goes through, why don't they put Tent City first?
The city is working to identify a year-round campground, but that takes time. The city manager has proposed delaying any camping ban until mid-April when the city-run Thane Campground reopens. The ordinance's main proponent is Juneau Mayor Ken Kelch.
We need to deal with our homeless problem. We need to deal with our safety problem. And we need to deal with both of them right now. And that's the perspective I'm taking on it.
The ACLU of Alaska says that a camping ban targeting homeless people is arguably unconstitutional. Executive Director Joshua Decker sent an email blast to its members in Alaska encouraging people to write the city opposing the ordinance.
What the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit has said in a case out of L.A. is that when a city does not have enough shelter space for everyone who needs shelter, it cannot criminalize the simple human need of sleeping outside when there's nowhere else for people to go. And that's what we have in Juneau.
The city attorney's office disagrees, saying this ordinance would only apply to private property. Is the city on firm legal ground? That would be up to a judge to decide. But there's another wrinkle in all this. Homeless advocates warn that a camping ban could imperil the community's access to federal grant dollars. The Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD for short, funded two projects housing homeless people to the tune of $130,000 last year. The Alaska Coalition on Housing and Homelessness Executive Director Brian Wilson says HUD has a point system in ranking applications from a community, and criminalizing homelessness is frowned upon and can cause a community to lose points. And when it comes to HUD reviewing grant applications in Washington, it's a numbers game.
The higher your score, the more funding that you receive. The lower your score, you're at jeopardy of losing funds.
But could a camping ban really imperil federal funding? HUD, as a rule, doesn't get involved in policy debates, but HUD officials would talk freely about what approaches to tackling homelessness they encourage and discourage.
You know, most of the evidence shows, and I think most experts would agree, that homelessness is not a crime. Homelessness is a condition.
That's HUD spokesman Lee Jones in Seattle. How these communities decide to deal with homelessness is definitely a factor, Jones says, when ranking funding requests. This is an issue some assembly members want answered before the ordinance goes to a vote next week. And Mayor Kelch, He says he's talked to the city's D.C. lobbyist and congressional staffers for clarification, but hopes to get a camping ban passed regardless.
That would disturb me greatly to find out that a city that tries to help its citizens deal with trespassers on private property would suddenly not be received in the same light, and that we would definitely follow up on.
The Juneau Assembly likely won't take further oral testimony, but a vote is scheduled for Monday, February 13th. Expect a crowded house. In Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Hugh Neff arrived in Eagle this morning in second place in the Yukon Quest. The defending race champion pulled into the Yukon River checkpoint 3.5 hours after race leader Brent Sass. KUAC's Molly Reddick has more from Eagle.
Three more mushers came into Eagle Friday morning. Hugh Neff arrived second. As he opened up his food bags, he said the climb over American Summit was intense.
Yeah, it was probably the worst cold wind I've ever seen. It was brutal. And it's right in your face, you had to go right into it.
He could only see the first few sets of dogs through the wind, and they lost the trail a couple times.
They turned around twice on me, but we figured it out eventually.
He rested at the cabin at Clinton Creek on Thursday night. When he left, he saw where Alan Moore and Matt Hall were camped by the river.
And then Ed Hopkins was another couple miles behind them. It was funny because Ed's Canadian, so he was camped out on the Canadian side of the border. And those guys were camped out on the American side.
Teams take a four-hour rest and vet check in Eagle. Quest vets got initial results on what might have caused a dog death on Thursday. Yuka Honda had a dog collapse a few miles outside Dawson, and it was deceased by the time she got to the checkpoint. Visibly upset, she rode across the river to the vet station with the dog zipped in her sled bag. Firefly was a 6-year-old male who had been in good body condition throughout the race. Quest vet Nina Hansen said the initial necropsy showed an enlarged heart and multiple booties in the dog's stomach.
So at this point, we don't know which of those things or maybe both contributed, and we won't know that until the final report is done.
Hansen said eating booties is not uncommon.
Dogs like to eat things that they shouldn't eat. I mean, pet dogs eat toys, they eat rocks, they eat towels, they eat poop.
Normally a dog would get sick and vomit, but this dog just dropped without warning. They're waiting on the final necropsy to determine cause of death. On the Yukon Quest Trail in Eagle, I'm Molly Reddig.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their homes. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message brought to you by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Wesley Early. This week on AK, Turning Orange. High school and middle school students in Huna, a small village on Chichagof Island in southeast Alaska, spent several days in a special training to learn how to choose happiness every day. Huna City School officials believe the training will help the kids improve their lives. KTOO's Quentin Chandler joined the students to find out how to become an orange frog.
This story starts with Superintendent of Huna City Schools, PJ Ford Slack. She came to Huna as an emergency replacement for the district's last superintendent, and when she got to work, she noticed something.
The adults were really not happy. That didn't mean they actively knew that, but they seemed to be down.
Huna's community does feel a lot of stress. The isolated town's commercial fishing and processing industries dried up years ago. The school district is under heavy financial strain, and drug and alcohol dependence are growing concerns. Slack believes a teacher's attitude has a powerful impact on the kids they teach. So she started researching something called the happiness advantage. It's an idea based in research that points to a link between a positive mindset and success.
It seems to make sense that that would make a difference if the kids and the adults all learned a little bit about this and realized happiness was a choice.
The district in Hoonah used about $20,000 in grant funding from the federal government to bring in a training based on the work of author and motivational speaker Sean Aker. It's called the Orange Frog Project. The adults went through it months ago, and Slack says it's already changed some of their lives. Now it's the students' turn.
Woo! You're all set! Oh yeah, let them know. Let's go!
Devin Hughes is calling for high fives, teaching the kids and staff that they should do the uncomfortable, be outwardly positive even if it means being the weird one. Hughes is the chief inspiration officer for the International Thought Leader Network.
My whole mission, my tenet, is to go around and inspire, motivate others to achieve happiness and joy and optimism. It's pretty cool.
Hughes uses a comic book to jumpstart the training. It's a story about a bunch of sad green frogs and a happy frog who is slowly turning orange. The more the orange frog does to make himself happy, the better he gets at catching flies and the more orange he turns. Eventually, the other frogs copy him. They get happier, they catch more flies, and they start turning orange too. The moral is that happiness is a choice. It doesn't just happen. Hughes says his company travels to corporations around the world and to schools, teaching people to be orange.
So right now, I think schools are probably the fastest growing segment within our business, because if you can get a kid, whether it's a kid that's 6 or 16, and start to rewire their brain and doing these things more often and feeling pretty good, behavior issues go down, test scores go up.
But let's walk this back. Hughes is saying he is being paid to teach people to be happy. Doesn't anybody question that?
Oh, all the time. I mean, people are like, really? Really? If you think about it, when I ask the question, did you have anyone in your life when you were a youngster teach you this, give you the secret sauce to happiness? Something prescriptive, something actionable that you need to do to work on this, your mojo and your mindset. Universally, no one raises their hand.
He says after the initial skepticism, people usually jump in because who doesn't want to be happy? The high schoolers seem to be embracing the message. All around the room, kids are wearing orange wigs, frilly orange necklaces. They've got orange marker on their faces. Any kind of prop or clothing they can find, they're wearing it.
First rule of Orange Frog, if something good happens, you have to talk about it. Because if you do not talk about it
to the brain, it's like it never happened. Hughes asks them to run the halls, delivering what he calls joy bombs to people all over the building. So the kids give people unexpected high fives, hugs, and tell them they're awesome. Hughes tells them to think about how to stop their problems from keeping them down. He tells them to think about changing behaviors that affect everyone, things like bullying or ignoring kids they usually don't hang out with. Some of the kids say Orange Frog definitely changed their school's atmosphere, but will it last? Senior Kelsey Tyne isn't sure.
I think only time will tell with that one. I can see that a lot more people are upbeat than normal, and if it stays, it stays.
Other kids think they can easily turn their school orange in the long term. Superintendent Slack hopes so, too.
I'm hoping that this will help them, as they go through their life, know that they can make some choices and that those choices are tough sometimes. Life is tough, but there are ways that we can turn the frown the other way around and make it a smile.
She doesn't see this as some kind of silver bullet, but she hopes learning the Orange Frog strategies will help them develop better coping skills to handle whatever life throws their way. Reporting in Hoonah, I'm Quentin Chandler.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week, we're hearing from Philip Eben in Anchorage. He was born in Unalakleet.
I spent a lot of time with my mother, because I was intrigued as a child because she made mukluks and slippers and she did a lot of hand sewing. So My intrigue caught her eye, and so what I would end up doing is I would chew on the soles of the mukluks to form them for her, because that's the way they formed them back in the day. My dad is Francis Powak Eben. He was a great man. He built a lot of houses here in Alaska. He was part of the Territorial Guard, and he's also pictured in the book Men of the Tundra, being awarded a medal by Colonel Muktuk Marston for defending Alaska against the Japanese. So when my dad went to missionary schools when he was a child, every time he spoke Inupiat, they wiped his mouth out with soap. So he decided that when he had children, that none of his kids would ever have to go through that. So all we learned was English. My mother and father, they were killed by their eldest son December 7th of 1976, with all the anger that I grew up with due to my brother. So I had all this anger I didn't know what to deal with, so I lashed out. And therefore, I ended up with 72 arrests, 52 convictions. It's bygone. I haven't been in trouble going on 10 years. I haven't been in jail in 10 years. And my whole family say it's my wife's doing. You know, a lot of the changes that I have gone through with the relationship with my wife has been very positive, you know, and I thank God every day for it.
Philip Edmond lives in Anchorage. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Quentin Chandler, Ann Hillman, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Wesley Erb.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman and Jacob Resnick in Juneau, Molly Reddick in Eagle, Elizabeth Harbaugh and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
The Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta Subsistence Regional Advisory Council is meeting in Bethel February 15th and 16th at the AVCP Housing Authority Conference Room from 9 to 5 to develop proposals to change federal subsistence wildlife and trapping regulations for the 2018 to 2020 regulatory years and discuss other issues related to subsistence. The public is encouraged to participate either in person or by teleconference. For all the information about the meetings, go online to doi.gov/subsistence/regions or call 800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. Contact the Office of Subsistence Management to receive meeting documents or to request special accommodation needs by 7 business days prior to the meeting. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.